right, welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you so much for joining us. It's great to have you here. My name is Henrik. This is Red Ice Radio. Today we're doing the radio version. As you might know, if you're a regular listener, we do the video sometimes, but now and then we stick to radio only, of course. But you can check everything out at redice.tv and redicemembers.com, whether that's audio or video. All right, well, today we're speaking with Jim Horn. He's a ex-diplomat, an American diplomat with Swedish heritage. He recently actually wrote a open letter to the Swedish people, to the Islamification that's going on with the country. He was talking about defending your rights in the letter. And, of course, Jim is seasoned in this, if you will. He's actually written three books on this topic when it comes to the Islamification of the West. One of them is called Experiencing Islam. One is Muslim Men Fear Women, and also Islam in the Workplace. Three very interesting books, and we're going to talk more about that here today, of course. But welcome to the show, Jim. It's good to have you here.
It's wonderful to be here. Thank you.
Tell us a bit about your background first, Jim. And you worked as a diplomat, you said, and of course this is giving you a unique experience into this kind of world. What kind of work did you do?
Well, I worked a variety of jobs as a diplomat. And embassies are often quite small, so you wore three or four or five different hats. And every time I'd move from one embassy to another, my job and my role would change and grow. And I spent several years working on embassy security in different ways, working against penetration and infiltration by the Soviet bloc. And then later on, I was an embassy security officer. Things became more violent. So I got involved in gathering intelligence on terrorists, working in counterintelligence, and working in counterterrorism. I have 10 years' experience in the Middle East, in Turkey, in Algeria, Bangladesh, and then I traveled and worked throughout the Persian Gulf for a couple of years, making American embassies bombproof. After they blew up the embassy in 1983 in Beirut, in April, they blew it up again, the new embassy, in October. Then they blew up part of the embassy in Kuwait at Christmas time. I had had earlier experiences in Cambodia, providing security at the embassy. I had also done it in Burma, and I had also done it in Bangladesh. These are just my own innovation, basically. So I had been in Washington in 1983 for about 6 months, undertaking some various training in counterintelligence and stuff like that. That was put together by the CIA, the State Department, and Syracuse University. And I was selected and specially trained to be a hostage negotiator, because that was back when they were doing a lot of hostage taking.
Yeah.
And I was one of about 25 or 30 people. We were dispersed around the world. There were very few hostage takings after that, so I never got called up. But I did get called in to work on a special project that had been established to make about 55 embassies around the world that were really high threat, safe from truck bombs. And I interviewed with the guy that was in charge of the office. He reported directly to the Secretary of State. So we were kind of a blister on the side of the bureaucracy. We didn't have to go through all of the bureaucratic hassle to do what we needed to do. And Congress had provided us with funds to go ahead and do what we had to do. So I talked to him. I was told to go talk to him, and we spoke for about 5 minutes, and I found myself with a desk, a budget, and an assignment to make American embassies in North Africa, that was Algeria and Tunisia, and the Persian Gulf, Iraq, Kuwait, Bahrain, United Arab Emirates, Dubai, Muscat and Oman, and a couple of others bombproof, as well as the American embassy and four consulates in Pakistan. And I went to work on that because one of my friends had been killed in Beirut, so I had a serious personal commitment and a passion to get this done right. And I guess I did it right because none of those embassies have been blown up. when we finished our projects, we asked for more money to do other embassies that we thought were also under threat, such as Nairobi. And the Congress didn't provide the funding, and as we all know, the American embassy in Nairobi and in Dar es Salaam were both blown up by Al-Qaeda a little bit later on.
Yeah.
So that's one of my claims to fame, is that I was successful in doing that. And we had, when I first started in that, I spent a couple of weeks up at an Army base making things explode and watching them explode with video cameras so I could learn the physics of the blast effects and stuff like that, and then start designing things to work to protect from that, because there was really no architectural standard or anything like that that had been created yet. So it was just basically go off and wing it. And that was my assignment. Do what you have to do. So the first embassy that I had was sent off to work on, we had information that the bad guys, Iranians, had a Chevrolet Suburban, and they were assembling the same type of a bomb that they had used against the embassy in Beirut, basically propane and detonation cores. That's what they used at the Marine barracks in Lebanon as well, where they killed 241 Marines. Mm-hmm. And they were preparing one to go after the embassy. And so I was sent out there to see what we could do about it. The embassy was a 450-year-old building built with the traditional materials of the time, which were sand, camel dung, and straw. It was not a very sturdy structure, and we wanted to do something about it. And the landlord's representative would not let us do anything. We talked with the city. We talked with the foreign ministry. Nobody would let us do anything to the building because it was a 450-year-old sultanic palace, and it was a historical monument, so we couldn't touch it. So we were really kind of frustrated, and then we sat down one night, and the architect and I were having a few beers together. He scribbled something on a napkin. In the morning, we made a more coherent drawing of it. Basically, there were boxes that you could plant things in, and we went out and we qualified some local contractors and issued contracts that day. That was one of the nice things about this office. I had the authority to do that. And within 2 days, they started surrounding the embassy with about 90 of what I called flower boxes. They were 1 meter deep, 2 meters wide, 1 meter high. You fill them up with sand, dirt, flowers, and water. But we anchored them together with aircraft cable, and we also put pilings into it to hold them into the ground, and we surrounded the embassy. These are basically stop a tank. They're now called planters, but the bad guys took one look at what we were doing, and they gave up and they went home. But they issued a fatwa against me.
Oh, really? Jeez, that's amazing. And so you must have. So you've seen some of this, obviously, up close. You've seen the Islamists' actions up close, so to speak. You must be flabbergasted that Europe, with unfortunately our open door policy, is kind of letting people come over the border that have been causing these issues in other countries, right?
Well, yeah, we're letting people in who hate us. I mean, this has been going on since the 1940s. It just hasn't come up to be as significant and widely observed as it is now. But it's been a stealth jihad attack against the United States that's been going on for 55, 60 years. And it's really gaining a crescendo now, and it's really coming up fast because the more and more people come in, the more bold they get.
That's right. They grow in numbers, and now, of course, we see almost a fever pitch frequency being reached with this, including retaliations, as we saw in England here just yesterday, or the day before, with a counterattack of this British guy, a father of four, driving over people outside of a mosque. You know, this is... We can get into this in detail later. There's a lot to say about this, of course. But before we get ahead of ourselves and talk about those things that currently is going on, I wanted to ask you specifically a little bit about your letter that you wrote. It was published on, I guess you would call it the new paper, Nya Dagbladet, in Swedish. It was an open letter. It was about a little bit about, of course, your background and your ancestry, your connections to Sweden, and also, of course, your reaction to, as you've seen, what our leaders have done towards our country and towards its people. Can you tell us about that a little bit and why you wanted to write this letter?
Well, because Sweden is in much more dire straits than the United States, but the United States is probably following that with the liberal governments that want to be all inclusive. And this is one of the things that Sweden is suffering under. Years ago, they started bringing in a few refugees to try and help them out and stuff like that. And they were a rich, prosperous country, very charitable people. So that was okay. But as these people have gained in numbers, They have developed their own enclaves called no-go zones in Sweden. They've driven people out of their homes, out of the communities. They've taken over things. The fire department, the police, the post office, even ambulances are going to those areas with great trepidation because they're going to be under attack by people who will not tolerate them. This is one of the things that I've said in my books, is that we in the West pride ourselves on our tolerance. And the question I ask is everybody is, have we become so tolerant that we tolerate those who will not tolerate us?
That's right.
And that's what's happening in Sweden. And the leadership in Sweden hasn't gotten the message yet. I don't understand how they get there into their votes and stuff like that, how the people elect them. But it is a serious problem in Sweden in that the leadership is allowing this terrible stuff to persist and to continue, and they're still bringing more and more and more of these refugees in, people who get off the plane hating. They just hate anybody who is not one of them. If you're not a Muslim, you're going to be hated. That's what the Quran teaches. That's what Muhammad taught in the Quran that he wrote.
We saw a counteraction after this stuff with the no-go zones started coming out. And we heard, of course, by most of the international liberal media saying that this was just a lie, that these no-go zones didn't actually exist. And I still to this day hear this when I try to bring it up and just say, you know, listen, we can get into technicalities of what you mean when you say no-go zones or what other people mean. But the reality is, of course, that there are certain areas where Swedes just don't go. And if they were to go there, they would swiftly be known that they're not welcome there. They might even risk their lives if they go there. What would you say to people who don't think or believe that no-go zones actually exist?
They're living in a fantasy world. They're living in a world of denial. And this is the tragedy that I see, and that's why I wrote this letter, to try and get more information, to get more of the Swedish people involved and interested in what's happening in their own backyard. And it's happening in other countries in Europe as well. All over Europe, it's happening in the United States. It's really taking off in Canada.
Yeah.
Because the Prime Minister Trudeau is just, well, he doesn't have a lick of sense.
I don't know what's wrong with that guy, but he just can't take a stand, that guy.
Yeah.
It's funny. Now, so you say in the letter, you actually ended the letter with the following. Your leaders are willfully ignorant cowards of the worst order and are leading you, all of you, down the path to perdition with your tolerance of those, quote, refugees, unquote, who are not refugees but colonizing invaders that despise you. Some of your Muslim, quote, guests, unquote, are already now taking over parts of Sweden and creating hostile outposts where they are waging warfare on you in our own houses. The time is for you to rouse your soul and defend what is rightfully yours. I think we've been taught that. I mean, you might not be familiar with the intricacies of you know, Swedish politics and the kind of the level of propaganda and anti-Swedish sentiments that exist both in education and academia and the media and stuff like that. But we've been told that we don't really, you know, own the country. It's not really ours, and we stole it from other people, and we are all immigrants and this kind of stuff. Almost, you know, the same thing that Americans hear, of course, these days. But it's very difficult to get people to understand that it's like, this is you and your ancestors that worked for this. They're the ones who worked to get the nation into the position where it was, to be able to have certain privileges and for them to work so that these were beneficial to you and not have handed over to strangers that actually hate you at the end of the day, right?
That's right. The fact that we Americans are here in America. We took over America. There were a few Indians, and they did not do well with the coming of the Europeans. The Europeans were just like the colonizers that you have in Sweden. They didn't tolerate the local people, and that was very unfortunate. We've done a lot of things to try and rectify that, but that was an unfortunate happening, and it's what's happening in Sweden. And Sweden is at risk of ceasing to exist as a nation, as a culture, and anything else that is not dominated or controlled by Islam. And when the Islamists totally take over, it is going to be a very, very sad day. And the Swedes are going to lament that, like I am lamenting what's happening in Sweden now, because these colonizers are not friendly, and they're not tolerant, and they will not tolerate the Swedish people. That's one of the things I mentioned in there, that the women and children are going to become slaves, and the men will be abused and killed and everything else. Mm-hmm. This is very real. If you look at the history of Islam, Muhammad started his missionary work in Mecca, and after 13 years, he only had 150 or so followers, and he was driven out of Mecca, and he went to Medina and tried to do the same thing there, trying to be a missionary Christ-like, and he was rejected by the people in Medina. So he basically sat down on a rock, and he said, okay, I've been trying this Christ-like missionary-type thing for 14 years, and it hasn't worked. I think I'm going to change my work model. And he started killing and pillaging and going after people and dominating people, and that worked very well for him. He had all these brigands came and joined him. They were there for the money. They were basically mercenaries. But they also said he compelled them to follow his Islam and be Islamist. And by the time he died, there was not a Christian or Jew or any other enemy left alive in the Saudi Peninsula. And so this is you know, an example of how Islam grew out of nothing, and then a angry man who became very powerful, a warlord. He was very clever, very smart. He did a lot of stuff. And on the day he died, or at the time he died, he told his followers to never, never, never give up until the entire world is under the domination of Islam. And Islam means submission, because everybody has to submit to the will of Allah. Of course, Allah is a creation of Muhammad. And so, but it's a religion that is stuck in so many people's minds that they think that their Allah is the superior thing, and that there will be no peace on earth until everybody submits to Allah, which is true. But when they submit, they're going to be living in suffering, poverty, and misery. And that's what Islam brings to every country it's gone to. If you take a look at history, Egypt was one of the greatest Christian nations in the world.
Yep.
And the Muslims did what they're doing in Sweden. They did what they're doing in the United States. They started moving in. They were good neighbors, they were friendly, they were helpful, et cetera, until the numbers grew and grew in numbers, and as their own communities got larger, they became more hostile, and at a certain point, they just flat took over Egypt. They disallowed any Christians to have any weapons, any way of defending themselves, and they just submitted them to some horrible things going on. The libraries at Alexandria contain hundreds of thousands of scripts, of manuscripts, one of a kind, writings and history and philosophy and everything else that the Muslims took out and burned because they did not talk about Muhammad or Allah. And that all that antiquity was lost. It was just destroyed. And when they took over Egypt, they started destroying the people. And you see what Egypt is now. It's a country of impoverishment, of suffering, of fear, and where the Christians really live a horrible life. But it takes a lot of courage to stay Christian under those type of circumstances.
Yeah, just the bombing that was a couple of weeks ago now, one of the ancient Coptic churches down there, just horrific. And these people are hell-bent on getting these people away from there and conquered and away. And I mean, if you look at the material of someone like Dr. Bill Warner over at Political Islam, he shows the ruthless conquest over a 1400-year period, you know, because we hear, of course, in the West all the time about, the Crusades, and, you know, it's their anger with us, and we're just getting, it's just payback for that or whatever. But if you actually look at the maps of, you know, number of conquests and strikes against, let's say, from the Muslim side towards the Europeans and vice versa, the Crusades is nothing. And I mean, that came after, 350 years of ruthless attacks, right?
Yes. And, you know, the Muslims went into Spain, Iberia. They dominated it for 700 years until King Ferdinand and Queen Isabella were able to drive them back across the water into Morocco.
1492, that's when they did it, yeah.
That's 1492. And then the Ottoman Turks, of course, they tried to conquer Europe going through Vienna. And they were stopped by Christian fighters. The king of Poland came down with his forces, and he helped defeat the Muslims at the gates of Vienna, which is very, very significant. And 9/11 was the date that they fell. That's a very significant date for the Muslims. That's why they attacked us on 9/11.
Was it the Hazards or something, right? The Polish
winged
army, I think, right?
They were the Polish mounted cavalry, the Hussars, and they wore these outfits that when the horses ran, it made a whistling sound that terrified a lot of people. And they just came and they just really kicked butt. And the Turks collapsed, the Turkish army collapsed and fell and it left. Of course, a lot of Turks stayed behind, and that's where you have these Islamic communities in the former Yugoslavia.
Yeah.
And you would have, of course, there, and they started something after Yugoslavia fell apart. They actually initiated the problems with the Serbians.
That's right. And why the hell did America side with Bosnia against the Serbs and the
others? Because Bill Clinton and his people were either bought and paid for by the Muslims, or they were so stupid, and then they had too many Muslim advisors already in the government telling them how terrible the Serbians were, and that they had to go and bomb the Serbians to protect the Muslims from the Christians, which is one of the most ridiculous, insane things that we have ever done in our history. But we do a lot of insane, stupid things. We're still involved in Afghanistan after 15 years.
Yeah.
You know, I tell people, and I remind people, I guess it doesn't sink in yet, that the British spent 160 years in Afghanistan, left with their butts in a basket. The Soviets went in there for 20 years with 500,000 men, and they left with their butts on a silver platter. And I say, what the hell are we going to do there with 15,000 people?
Yeah.
Where our troops are suffering more gunshot wounds from our allies than they are from the enemies. So our allies are our enemies because we are Christians. We are on Muslim soil, and they detest us just because we're there. So why are we going to send another 4,000 people in there? I know General Mattis is probably a great statistician, but he does not understand Islam. And that is going to lead to more deaths, more body bags coming home, and I'm against it. I think we need to find some way to neutralize Afghanistan, and that would be to take the 5 or 6 different tribal areas and create a separate nation in each one of them,
mm-hmm.
Let them be dependent on us.
You know, nationalism is a good solution to all these wars and problems. I think forcing people together and displacing people and taking different groups and moving them half across the world and resettling them and all this nonsense, it's chaos. It's going to lead to chaos, and that's what it's done. I think you're right. I think that a solution where each people, I mean, look at the Kurds in Turkey, for example, how long they've been fighting, and also how ruthless, of course, the Turks have been, you know, against the Kurds. But every people would do well having their own territory where they have their own language, their own culture. They can dictate themselves what they want to, how they want to live and with whom and all these kinds of things. I think that the problem begins, of course, when you do have a very invasive foreign policy. When you couple that with accepting refugees from those countries, I know Trump has tried to stop that, but now some of the judges and stuff, of course, have come in and blocked his, that so-called travel ban and this kind of stuff. But how does it make sense, do you think, to have a policy where you literally go into another country, you invade another country, you drop bombs on these people, and then you invite them into your country as refugees? I mean, how can the generals and the authorities just not be in a position where they say, you know what, that's not a good idea. That's like letting potential enemy combatants in behind your own, behind your lines, right?
No, it's a very, very foolish thing to do, and it's something that's going to cause a lot of harm, maybe a lot of destruction over the long run, as you're seeing it starting to grow in Sweden with increasing violence with the Islamists there. against the Swedish people. And the Swedish people are going to have to realize that they're going to either have to get down on their knees and put their butts in the air and start grinding their foreheads on the ground and praying to Allah, or they have to stand up and be men and women to protect their language and their culture and their nation from these invaders. And it's a very serious thing. And if they don't do it, I hate to see what's going to go happen. I see where Denmark has just established where the postal people will not deliver mail in the Muslim enclaves anymore because of the danger to the mailman.
Yeah.
We just had a couple of incidents in Belgium and I think the Netherlands today, in France yesterday. It's just going on and on, and it's on a crescendo. It's not going to slow down. It's going to keep going and going until somebody really stands up and starts pushing back hard. And it's starting to get there, but the people who are pushing back are not yet working together. They're not yet coordinated, and they're not yet angry enough. I think you're seeing more of that with the Pegida in Germany. They're starting to push back. And they're going to probably push back a little bit harder. That's what we have to have in Sweden. That's what we have to have in Norway and Scandinavia.
Yeah.
And here in the United States and Canada, you have to push back or face extinction. And I mean serious extinction.
I know. It sounds at this point to some people who are still kind of trapped in the illusion and don't understand the seriousness of this, they might think that we're crazy. We don't have to talk like that because we don't have that kind of audience. But let's assume we have newcomers listening to this. They have to understand, I think most liberals, most leftists that are trapped in this idea that we're helping these people. And if we don't help them, we're kind of like we're contributing to the murder of them or something like that. They have to understand that, you know, there are other people that think differently from you that are religiously driven. They see this as a conquest. They see it as a fulfillment of a promise or a prophecy or these kinds of things. And they just have to wrap their heads around this fact that there are things that they are completely, you know, foreign to. And there's an obsession within the religion which these lefties just can't understand. What do you think if we just zoom out a little bit more and look at the bigger picture and ask about the mentality of those that are attracted to Islam, what that is and how, I mean, I know it's conversion. I know there is, I think the proselytizing obviously to a certain extent, but usually it's violent conversion by force of these people. Yes, I understand that. But once people are into it, let's say, or grow up in it, is it the simplicity in the concept, the instructions and the very basic fundamental components of their religion that's appealing? Or why do you think people stay in it and continue to push it on others? What's the appeal?
The appeal is that people don't understand what they can do if they leave, and they understand that if they do leave, their life is forfeit in many cases. They are ignorant of what other teachings are. There are some missionaries who have been successful in getting some message out to the Islamists, but it's, again, it's too many different people trying too many different things and nothing is coordinated. And then the fact that if somebody apostatizes, they're probably going to die very quickly. And it's, or they have to go into hiding or they have to do other things. And you see that all the time. We have organizations here in the United States that do help Muslim women who want to break away from the terrible situations that they're in. So, and that's happening a lot more than people will admit. And the left, of course, will not admit this at all. And the left is enamored with Islam because they probably get a lot of their money and support indirectly or directly from Islam. And that's how they do this thing. I mean, it's pervasive. It's all over the place. And it's a serious problem. It's something that we have to try and work with and do stuff. That's why I'm trying to do things to educate people with my books. My other two books are, one of them is Islam in the Workplace.
Mm-hmm.
In the United States, 15 years ago, had instances where people at Dell Computer, at meatpacking houses, and other companies, Maytag appliance makers, they had a lot of Muslim employees, and the Muslim employees decided, okay, now we're going to shut down your assembly line a couple of times a day to have our prayers and do our voodoo and all that stuff in the middle of the shop floor. And the company said, no, you can't do that. And then they got sued, and they lost in the courts because the judges were ignorant of what they were dealing with, so they just thought it was an employee relation thing. It was much more than that. And the Council on American Islamic Relations prepared a guideline that they sent off to employers all over the United States saying, if you have Muslim employees, this is how you have to treat them. And it didn't talk about Christian employees or Jewish employees or Buddhist employees. This is how you got to treat your Muslim employees, and it was put out by a Muslim organization. So I got a hold of that, and I basically dissected each and every paragraph. And I wrote, in the book, I put the paragraph, and then I put a second paragraph debunking the first paragraph. And it goes like that throughout the whole book. For instance, they want to have prayers five times a day. Well, the Quran itself says you need to pray five. But if you're busy, if you're making war, if you're involved in other kind of stuff.
Yeah, that's right. If you're killing other people, it's okay. You don't have to do it. Right?
If you're killing other people or raping women or whatever,
that's
okay.
Fine. That's kind of a process of the religion in itself, right? So that's fine. You're still actively engaged in it.
But it basically says that if you're occupied doing something, you can make up your prayers at the end of the day. Well, that's what I point out in this book, and I've sent copies off to different companies. A lot of people have been buying it. Small businesses have been buying it, and they're printing up their employee handbooks and putting this information in there. So when a Muslim employee is hired, here's your handbook, and you sign for it, and you better read it and understand what's in it, because if you violate the rules of the handbook, you're fired. And then they come in and they start trying to pull the Muslim stuff in the middle of the work floor, and the companies fire them. And these guys say, well, I'm going to take you to court, and they run off to care, and they go back to court, and the employer can go to the judge and say, here, the guy signed this guideline. He has this guideline. He knows what the rules. He violated the rule. He got fired. Done deal. Because I grew up in Minnesota, and Cargill's headquarters is there, I sent them a draft copy of this early on. And I believe they incorporated that into their employee handbook. And, of course, this has been a slow evolutionary thing, but they got the handbook out. They had a meatpacking plant someplace out here in the Midwest where they had a problem with Islamic workers who decided that they didn't want to do something, and the company fired over 300 of them. The people went to work and said, we were wrongfully terminated. The court said, yes, you were. Cargill, you're gonna have to rehire these people. Cargill said, fine, but here's our new handbook. Sign it. And if you don't want to sign it, we're not gonna hire you back.
Yeah, I was just gonna say they shouldn't hire them anyway, but there you go. That's a way out of their BS that they're trying to push on people. Now, what do you know about the refugee resettlement programs? I mean, it's been exposed that there's tons of money in this. Not only hiring refugees, but it's a way, the whole immigration circus is, of course, it's a way to dump wages in America. And of course, beyond the leftists in the government, a lot of businesses has now gotten, you know, cued in on this. And they've realized that this is a great way around, you know, unions. And as you said, there's actually, for some reason, like meat processing plants are bringing in people. We know about places like Chobani, of course, he's actually Kurdish, the guy, Hamdi Ulukaya. He's actually Kurdish, but he's a Turkish national, citizen of Turkey. Yes. And he has been also at the forefront. I mean, he knows George Soros. He's a personal friend with Chuck Schumer. He was given money early on to actually buy some of the processing plants where he made cheese, feta cheese initially, and then he went over to yogurt later on. But he's made it his moral quest to hire refugees and seeing this as something really good, of course. But it's also become like a back-end way for him to bring in Muslims into America, into places such as Twin Falls. What do you know about this, and how are the companies tied into this?
Well, Chobani is tied in with the different refugee programs. And these refugee programs, like the Lutheran World Services, Catholic World Services, the Jewish Services, they are all in it for the money. And they go and they get grants from the State Department. And then they go back to the State Department and say, we want you to bring in more people because we've got all this grant money, and we can afford to take them out and settle them down and get them into the different positions. And this is what they've been doing. Basically, they bring them into a community, they get them into a apartment, pay a couple months rent, and then they leave them, and then the local community has to deal with them. Okay, with Trevani, they got a job. In other places, they get a job. A lot of places, they don't have a job. So they wind up going on welfare, and they get very demanding. They're not employed, and they want more and more and more. And the communities are so ignorant that they keep giving them more, and that's the wrong thing. They need to say, you want something? You have to get a job. We'll give you job training. You learn English. You start doing your job the way you're supposed to. And these people, of course, think, well, I'm Muslim, and because Muhammad said that I'm superior, a superior being to a Christian, I don't have to take your orders. Matter of fact, your constitution, I don't have to follow the laws because the Quran and Sharia are Muslim, and they're more important than what you have. So this is a conflict that's building and is an ebb and flow, and it's going to build up to a crescendo. One of the big things in the United States right now is to try and destroy our First Amendment, the right of free speech, to say anything that anybody says against a Muslim into hate speech, and they want to put us in jail for it. That's what they're trying to do in Sweden. That's what they're trying to do in Europe. And the First Amendment is a two-pointed sword, and one of the points is coming back at us, the United States. Yes, we have freedom of religion, but people are using this freedom of religion thing to build all these mosques over the country and to start proselytizing Islam as fast as they can.
Yeah.
And we are suffering from our own First Amendment. This is not a good deal.
No, it's not, and that's, of course, does show some of the flaws in the amendments to the Constitution. And of course, people have pointed out before that the kind of, you know, equality that they talk about in the Constitution could also be used against people in this way. Now, we don't have to get into that debate now, but of course, some people theorize, well, this, they were not talking about, when they wrote this stuff, they were not talking about foreign religions, which they were not aware of at the time. They were talking about whether you're a Huguenot or a Roman Catholic, right? Everyone is, it's freedom of religion in America to a certain extent. But one note I want to stay on a little bit is this aspect of comparing it to the settlement of other areas, right? Because I think you brought up an important point. If we take this from a leftist point of view, they constantly talk about the evils of Europeans who came to America and colonized and settled there, right? So that's, it's a clear double standard, because when we did it, it was wrong. But now when it's happening again, it's the right thing, right? And it's even worse than that, because when Europeans came to different parts of the world, in most cases there was not a government structure set up there. There was no welfare offices people could go to. They had to, yes, in some cases, you know, fight off local tribes. In some cases, it was disease that fought off them for them, if you will. But they have to make a life for themselves. It was a very hard life. They settled. They pioneered stuff. In this case, it's we, the taxpayers, are actually paying for our colonizers, not only to come to our countries, but to live off of us and colonize us on our own behalf. It's a very different situation today, isn't it?
It really is. When the Europeans came, a lot of the Europeans were Christians and more charitable. And they were not always that hostile to the local natives. The most barbaric European settlers were the Spaniards. They came over here and did to the Indians what the Muslims did to the Spaniards when they conquered Spain. And, there's some pretty bad things that have been going on. We have to understand that we have done these things. This is part of our evolutionary process and civilizational process. And like I often respond to people when they talk about Christian barbarianism and the Crusades and stuff like that. And I point out that the Crusades were in direct response to the sacking of Rome by Muslims.
Mm, yeah.
And when they talk about, oh, the Christians do all these terrible things, I go back and I say, when was the last time a Christian burned somebody at the stake? Then I say, when was the last time a Muslim cut somebody's throat? About 5 seconds ago.
Yeah, someone stoned to death or thrown off a building or whatever. Yeah, happens quite regularly. And they never, of course, moralize them or say, you know what, we got to Sure, they might get there one day, but you know, they're not saying like, let's go to Saudi Arabia and clean up their government abuse there. You know, they look the other way, and instead they say, you know what, let's bring these people to our countries. That's going to fix it, right? With all the gay rights that they want to push and all this kind of stuff, they're bringing in people that are literally anti-gay, and it's just such a mess. It's such a chaotic situation that is being created here. And I wonder sometimes, Jim, I want to get your take on this, but do they is there on some subconscious level they just want to create chaos and they want to destroy? They have a kind of a hostility to our own civilization towards the West, and on some level they see this as a way to lead to its destruction? Or is that going, is that over-psychologizing this thing?
It's a mixed bag, I think. You've got the communist influence, and you've got the Islamic influence, and you put the two together, and you have anarchy. And that's what these people are. They are anarchists. They want to tear down, they want to destroy anything and everything that they don't like. And they're tearing down and destroying things that are beneficial to them, but they're not bright enough to realize that. One of the things that here in California, we've got universities that educate students, but they leave colleges with no critical thinking skills. All they do is, all they come out of college now is spouting off communist BS and balderdash.
Yeah.
That is really quite meaningless, but that's important to them because they don't know anything else. The law schools do not teach the Constitution anymore. So you've got people coming out of law schools with degrees in law who don't know this one word about the Constitution because it was never handed to them. They were never told to read it. They were never told to read the Federalist Papers or read some of the stuff put out by the early creators of our Constitution. And they don't care. They just want to go out and rip people off and make money. And that's what these lawyers do. And they want to, if a Christian looks crosswise at a Muslim, and the Muslim complains, right now you got Kier with a bunch of Islamic-based lawyers. They're going to run out and they're going to sue. And this is something that we Christians need to get our heads together and start practicing the lawfare on the Muslims that they're practicing on us. We have to strike back and push back, and more people are doing that. And we need to. This is the same thing in Sweden. You have to get people have to get up there and they have to go file petitions against the government, against the immigration, and cause elections, and get these liberals, the Swedish government, voted out. That's what this guy Breivik in Norway was about 10 years ago when he went off and started killing all those people. They were all ultra-liberals bringing in the Muslims. Breivik was probably way ahead of his time, should we say, in dealing with this.
Yeah, he was. He was, obviously, but in a weird kind of way, he saw what's happening, and of course this is seen as murderous insanity by us, by the rest of the people, and by many people, I should say. But the reality, though, is that what started to happen now is that we're willing to put our own children's future at risk, their lives at risk, their lives somehow is less important than these other people's lives, right? It's this idea that, okay, well, there might be some bad guys among the people coming in, but they're willing to take that price to help the others. And in other words, what society and the leadership has said is, we don't value our own people. We value these other people first. They're the most important ones. And we have to let those people in. Otherwise, we are evil. We are wicked. If we don't do this, yada, yada, etc. But why is it that, why can't these people just go to the closest country that is not in a state of war and stay there, which is in accordance with the UN rules, I guess you should say, on the refugee situation, right? Why do they have to be moved from halfway across the world to another culture, which is completely incompatible? They don't speak the same languages, they don't have the same values or anything like that. That's the insane part in this, right?
Well, the UN is a huge part of the problem now. the 57 states of the Organization of Islamic States Cooperation, they now control and dominate the United Nations. The U.S. has nothing there. We have a vote on the Security Council and a little else. So when the U.N. says do this, it's 57 Muslim countries working together are creating these rules. The U.N. High Commissioner for Refugees doesn't respond to refugee needs. They're responding to the Muslim leadership, telling them what to do. And the Muslims have taken over the UNHCR. They've taken over a lot of these other organizations. So that's where you get this directing of Muslim refugees who aren't really refugees. They're most of them are 18 to 36 years old without families in the military age, and they're very aggressive. And this is what they're sending into these countries because they're sending warriors in. And I identify mosques as forward operating bases in military terms. They go in to communicate, they set up their mosque, they start doing whatever they want to do, and they're all too often allowed to do these things, which are really, really quite nasty and reprehensible. So it's not a good deal for us, and it is a good deal for them. This is where we're making the mistake. In Sweden, in Germany, in France, all over these countries, there are a couple of countries who know the Muslims much better than we do, and that's Russia and China. Mm-hmm. They've been dealing with them on their frontiers for 1,000 years, and they're not allowing it. For instance, when they had the Olympics in Sochi, the Muslims right away wanted to said, "Oh, well, we don't have a mosque in Sochi. We want to build a mosque there." Putin said, "No, you know, just that was it, net." And they did not get to build their mosque, and they might have fussed about it, but they kept the mosque kind of quiet because they knew they would have gotten their heads beat in if they'd gotten rowdy about it. It's not happening that way here. We need to have some people get up and say, "Nyet." One of the things that's happening here in the United States is ALAC, American Laws for American Courts. And I think it's over 35 states now have passed laws. The most recent one was Texas, that you have, that you honor American laws and American courts, and you do not honor outsider laws that are not helpful to us. And initially it was anti-Sharia. And that was always, whenever that issue came up like that, it was a religious issue and it got shot down. But when we're just saying American laws for American courts without any reference to Sharia, then it is working. So we've got more and more of that happening, but it's a slow process, but it's very, looks very good to see that happening. And there are a few states like Hawaii and California where the leadership is too far gone to do anything about that. But it's going to be coming and it's slowly coming, and it's an important thing to make sure that Muslim laws do not take place in American courts. We have New York, of course, and we have Detroit, and we have other states where they have got some communities that have some respect for some Muslim law, which is very hurtful to Muslims because Muslim woman gets a divorce, she doesn't get anything. She doesn't get any welfare, she doesn't get any support, she doesn't get the house, she doesn't get the children, she's out on the street. That's a Muslim divorce.
That's feminism and equality for you right there.
Yeah. That's one of the things we have to explain to people, teach people about. But so many people are just, they come home from work and they sit down and they turn on some game show or some dance show or something like that, and they don't even pay attention to what's going on in their country. And this is a real struggle to try and get this information to people to get them informed about what's going on.
Yeah, the bread in the circus is, Jim, you know, people always want that and they want to escape from reality. And when things start to go bad, in some cases, not always, but in some cases, they're more prone to even look harder the other way to try to avoid these issues and stay away from them. The problem, of course, is that we can deny, we can pretend it's not happening, we can look the other way, we can just stick our heads in the sands, but at some point it is going to reach our doorstep. And at that point, I hope that we're not going to be saying, well, it's too late at this point, you know, for people to wake up. And that's, of course, why we do shows like this. That's why you write the books that you do, are out there talking about this. And I want to talk a bit more about how you see, you know, Sweden from your end, what you think Swedes should do and this kind of stuff. I want to get into that in the second hour and talk more about how they view women, how Islam and Muslims view women and stuff like that. But before we just take a break here, Jim, Give us the titles again of the books you have out there on this issue, and where the best place to go is to pick up copies. Is it Amazon, or do you have a personal website out there?
I have a personal website, but the best place to get these is Amazon, or you can go to eBay and order, and then I'll sign it, and I'll mail it to you. Or if you want to get it much quicker, you just go to Amazon and get it there. So I have a website that lists my books. So it's just www.jameseshorn.com. And that lists my books. It also shows my blog postings and things like that. But Amazon is probably, people want to get a book quickly. They can get it on Amazon. They can get it, the electronic version of it, which is much, much cheaper. And they can have it right away. Or they can get the print copy and be on their way with it. And some of these print copies, I tell people, get three or four. Because you can give them out to other people, and the other people will probably appreciate the getting it. But, the next book we maybe talk about in the next segment is Muslim Fear Women. Muslim Men Fear Women. And it talks about what's happening to women in Sweden and happening to women in Germany and France and all these places like that. How the Muslims have changed the way people live dramatically already.
Yeah. Yeah. Good. JamesEhorn.com. That's a site. We'll obviously have that linked up then, folks. You can click through from there. And from there, of course, you have access to the books as well, Muslim Men Fear Women, Experiencing Islam, and also then Islam in the Workplace. So we're going to continue to talk more about this in the second hour. So stay with us, everyone. We're going to be right back at redeyesmembers.com. Thank you so much for this first hour, Jim. We'll take a short break, and then we'll be right back. I propose that you head on over to our members' website, redeyesmembers.com, right now. Get access to the second hour, not only of this show, but all the shows that we've done back to our start since 2006. We have over 1,300 programs for you on the members section. This includes, of course, all the radio shows, but also live TV shows, video segments, inside episodes, webcasts, and, well, pretty much everything that we've done back to our start. So head on over to redeyesmembers.com. It's only €6 per month. We have subscriptions going from 3 months up to 2 years. Available, and as I said, we are expanding right now. We don't have any commercials, advertisers, sponsors, or anything like that. This is the absolute best thing that you can do to help us out and support us in our endeavors. So help us bring you more coverage, reports, segments, shows, interviews, news coverage, live streams, all that good stuff. RedEyesMembers.com. Thank you so much for listening. We'll be right back.